Anyhow, we are past the 7:30, so I'm going to go ahead and mute all, as usual. And everybody will have the ability to unmute themselves. Please feel free to do so if you have a question or comment, and remute yourself afterwards so we keep background noise to a minimum. And welcome all, and I know that we have at least one new person with us tonight, so welcome to our guests. As always, we welcome guests at any time at the Auto PC as a group. And for those who don't realize, the URL that you use to connect up to this is a static URL for all our meetings, so if you just keep a hold of that, you'll be able to join in from that on any of our meetings in the future. If you do want to join the group, I paste it into the chat where you can go. If you just go to our homepage on our website and click on the Join or Renew button, that'll take you where you can all the various options for paying and filling out membership form and all the other lovely good stuff. We have a really big agenda tonight, and so I think right now I'll just turn it over to Alan to lead us through tonight's deck.
Yes, indeed. We have lots of topics. I think some of them are fairly short, so hopefully we'll get through everything. The first couple are actually kind of repeats from last week. The speaker was kind of late getting started, and I made a start on this deck, but if you hadn't seen these, I'll just mention them quickly. Previously, I asked about how to transfer the files from an iPhone to a PC for a friend of mine, and a whole bunch of people provided suggestions. Mostly, they were either using cloud storage as a transfer medium or using a USB cable to connect the two devices together. And I haven't heard which of those has been successful yet, but I'll keep in touch with my friend on that. And then the second thing was somebody had asked where to find the recycle bin and if there was an easy way to empty it. And I pointed out that what you can do is when you load up the recycle bin, if you click on this chevron in the top right-hand corner, it expands the ribbon which leaves these icons right here. So and Windows remembers that. So when you open it next time, you just click on empty the recycle bin, and it's just as easy as that.
However, Alan, I will point out that the ribbon is now gone from File Explorer in Windows 11.
Oh, well, I don't use Windows 11, so I can't be held accountable for that.
Okay.
All you Windows 10 users out there, it's really easy to do it in Windows 10. And Chris is going to tell you how to do it really, really easily in Windows 11 next week. Maybe. Okay, next up we have a reminder from Chris.
Yeah, this is the last reminder on that, Alan, if you give me slide control. Last reminder, because next week, next Wednesday night, rather than Q&A, we are going to be having our social get-together let me just get the slide control here. I don't know why it always takes two clicks. So the location, again, Big Rig in Gloucester Center. And so there's a link there to the Google Map on it. I will paste that into the chat in just a moment. So we have made arrangements for, I believe I made it for 22, which added a couple. Each participant is going to be on their own for actually paying for food and drink. However, even though we had a cutoff, we can add to that right up until about the day or two before then. So if you have not signed up and you want to, then do make sure that you send in, whoops, oh, Alan added the map there as well. So make sure you do send in to suggestionbox@opcag.ca. And if we run over the 22, I will call and add to our existing numbers. And that's it for that.
Yeah, oh. Just go back one there, Chris.
Okay.
Somebody asked where the big rig was, and there is another one in town. So just bear in mind, this is the one in the East End. And the other thing is, note here that the flash, there won't be a Q&A session on the 26th. So it's an in-person Q&A session. So if you have questions, you have to come to the Big Rig and buy a beer, and we'll answer all your questions there. But it is the Big Rig in the East End. So if you notice here, this is the Queensway is down the bottom there, and Blair Road is the exit. And there's lots of parking in the mall there. And also the O-Train station is right next to Walmart there. So it's very easy to get to, and lots of parking. Okay, Chris, the next one is yours too.
Yeah, okay. So last week I talked about USB charging and some of the options on it. And some of the people asked a little bit about the idea of different cables and things like that, and how you actually validate whether a cable will actually handle the power outage that you actually expect it to deliver. And so next, as it turns out, Lawn TV just had an entry in there in YouTube, and it was all about this topic of capabilities of cables. And so he had a whole mess of them, and he had hardware devices for testing cables and seeing what they're capable of doing. So one of the ones that he recommended, it's about $25 or so at Amazon.ca. And if you didn't want that, I couldn't find the BLE CaberQ, which is the one he actually recommended. He was saying it was about $120 or something like that, which I thought that's a lot for cable testers.
Yeah, I found it, and it came out to $180 Canadian.
Yeah, it's crazy. But there is another one in, called Treedix, the manufacturer is Treedix, and it was recommended in the comments to that video, and it's $60 at Amazon.ca, and seemed to be as capable.
But it is free shipping. It's $5 added, $6 added on
top. Oh, okay. Okay. So anyhow, I mean that if people are interested in being able to do actual testing on cables, there are some options on there so you can validate it. Other than that, if you just go for ones that are marked as being e-chips or whatever they call them, e-marked cables, they should be correct. And that's it for there.
I discovered that there's also a Thunderbolt 5 cable, which is essentially a USB 5.
Okay.
Also, the USB 4 all cables all have the e-chip in them.
Okay, good to know. They should all be marked anyways as whether they're capable and whether they're remarked or not. I just go by that, and I trust it. I would, I guess, keep my hand on it for the first couple of tries to see if it's warming up. If it's warming up, I'd throw it out and go with something else. I've never had a problem with any of the cables that were marked as 240-watt cables, and I've been quite happy with them. Okay, this next one is this came in as a recommendation anonymously to Suggestion Box, and it was about a site, Elder Abuse Prevention in Ontario. And they have all kinds of webinars. You can see the topics, some of the topics that are there. They have many, many more topics on there. But I highly recommend that you check it out and see if there's anything that you're interested in, and just watch the webinars right online. So just a heads up on that.
Okay, and another loony link came in from Stu, and this was an announcement from RCMP that they've launched a cyber crime and fraud website where you can report various incidents. So if you go to the actual link, then this is actually where you go to report frauds and scams and so on to the RCMP. okay, next up. Oh, yeah, next up we have a YouTube video, which I really like. And this is one of these Dave Plummer, the retired Microsoft engineer, software engineer. And he says that Windows sucks, but he also says how he would actually go about fixing it. And you notice here, in the graphic, he's got these great big oven mitts on his hands. And what he's trying to say is that Windows basically nannying people and not allowing power users to get on with their lives. So it's a really interesting video. And interesting enough, it actually made PC World, and they did an article on the same thing. So it's really good. Go ahead, Steve.
Yeah, he also admitted that the Windows sucks that he put on there was clickbait.
Yeah, but he
deliberately.
Yes, sure, but he goes through all of the things that he thinks is wrong with Windows, and he also, on the other side, tells you basically how they should be fixed or how he would fix them. And personally, I agree with just about everything he says. I think it's a really good video. And I hope somebody in Redmond is actually watching it. Yeah, good luck.
Yeah, I think so.
Okay, another Windows item. This is a website, but it's actually a website where people use webcams or cameras or whatever to record the view from their window, and then they post it online. And so it tells you where and when the picture was taken, and there's a free version and a paid version which have different features. And there's also a compilation video of 50 different windows, which is set to music. So you want to check that out. That came in from one of our members as something that she likes to do, and she says it's quite addictive. Okay, next up, we have a share on an AI product for note-taking, looking at complicated documents and summarizing them. And this is Elizabeth. You're going to unmute yourself, Elizabeth, and carry on.
Okay. At a previous Q&A, I think it was Steve Parker talked about Notebook LM, and I was kind of intrigued. So I decided to see what it was all about and maybe check it out with a what is normally a large document, like a bill or something from the government. And so I clicked on notebooklm.google, and this is what came up. I think the website has changed since I looked at this 3 weeks ago, but anyway, this is what came up for me. There's a bunch of notebooks at the bottom that I think are public and anybody can go through. But if you want to start a notebook, I clicked on create new on the right hand side. Next. And this is what came up. This is the start of a notebook. There are three what I'll call tabs, for want of a better expression: sources, chat, where you go back and forth with Notebook LM, and then studio that has all the output. I think I clicked somewhere on this page, perhaps the bottom left, to go to the next page to actually select some sources. Next. Yeah, so this is where you add your sources. You can add sources with Notebook LM, any kind of source from your hard drive on your desktop, your laptop. You can source stuff from the web in just about any format. I even think video, but PDF, text, documents. It even lists audio files and so on. So there's almost no end to the options you have for sources. I thought I'd keep it simple and just let the let Notebook LM discover some sources for me. And that would be interesting if you don't really have all the sources you think you need to get some content. So next, this is the Discover Sources page, and this is where you type in whatever you want. Like you could put in 2 pages worth of requests telling Notebook LM where to go and what you want out of it and what format you want back, bullet pages or whatever. In my case, I decided to select Bill 60 from the province of Ontario. That's, if I'm not mistaken, 2 years ago, Queen's Park brought in Bill 60, which is messing up our healthcare system. And I just wanted, these documents are huge, and I thought it might be interesting to see how Notebook LM would summarize this big document for me. So I clicked submit, next. And this is what I got. This is not the only list of sources that was presented, but that's all I captured on the page here. There were quite a few sources that Notebook LM came back with. First of all, the top source is the actual Bill 60 from the province of Ontario, and it came back with, among other things, a summary by the Ontario Health Coalition, and another summary, a critique by the Ontario Nurses Association. So on the right-hand side, I checked off Bill 60 to be imported, plus those other two critiques to see what I came up with. At this point, you'll note that I haven't given the notebook a title. I've just left it for now. Next. Okay, so here we are in the chat. This is the first output that came back to me. Interesting, Notebook LM has given me a title for my notebook, Ontario's Bill 60, Health Act Analysis. Excellent. I have no problem with that. The paragraph that it presents is interesting. It's an easy bite to chew. It opens up with a short, clear, concise, and accurate description of Bill 60 and what's in it. I don't think I could have written this better myself. And then it goes on to describe the two other sources, the two other analyses of Bill 60, one from Ontario Health Coalition and the other one from the Ontario Nurses. And it's interesting that I didn't ask Notebook LM to present the Ontario Health Coalition and the Ontario Nurses Coalition analyses as a critique of Bill 60, but that's how it's been presented here. And I guess it's because those two analyses that are done by the nurses and the Ontario Health Coalition are they're very critical of Bill 60. So I guess Notebook LM is taking its cue from that. But anyway, it was this little paragraph here does a very, very good job of summarizing those texts for me. And the other thing that's interesting on this page is Notebook LM suggests some questions for me, and they're excellent questions. Like at the bottom here, it says, what are the key changes? What are the key changes and new regulatory powers established by Bill 60? And another question, very pertinent, how does Bill 60 alter the financial accountability of our health services, and so on? So, I mean, it's presenting such intelligent and pertinent questions, it's astounding. Otherwise, you can start typing a question into Notebook LM, and you would probably want to confine your question to something that was pertinent to the sources you gave Notebook LM, naturally. But I decided to ask it a question that was prompted by what I read in the Ontario Health Coalition synopsis. Like I said, those two organizations, the nurses and the Ontario Health Coalition, are professional. They're accurate. So if they say something's wrong about Bill 60, it's very likely wrong. So I felt confident using those two sources in this experiment. But anyway, I decided to ask it a question about something that was in Bill 60. So next. Okay, so here is the question. I took a quotation directly from Bill 60, and I asked Notebook LM, does Bill 60 mean that people who were formerly restricted from using the title of doctor are now able to present themselves as a doctor, for example? And the answer came back from Notebook LM, yes, they could potentially allow individuals formerly restricted from using the title physician or doctor or nurse to use such titles, which is interesting. That's the point that was made up from the Ontario Health Coalition synopsis. And I just found it very, very impressive that Notebook LM came up with that. So, okay, next. This is, again, we're back on kind of the dashboard here with the three tabs. Studio is where we have the output, and this is where you can reformat the output from Notebook LM in a multitude of different ways. I mean, it was just astounding. I listened to the audio overview, for example. It was like a podcast. There was a male voice and a female voice, and they were talking about Bill 60 and what the nurses said and what the Ontario Health Coalition said, and it sounded extremely lifelike. I wouldn't know that that wasn't two individuals talking about the bill. It was really quite interesting. And I didn't look at the video, but I took a look at the mind map. In this case, it's such a a simple example. The mind map was just an illustration of Bill 60 and the different sections in it, like the purpose of the bill, the new community health services set up, the changes in the definition of doctors and nurses, and so on. And then the reports was interesting as well, but I'll get to that at the next slide. Flashcards and quiz would be extremely interesting and useful for kids that are studying for exams or anybody studying for something, because I'm sure that these questions would anticipate some of the questions on your exam, whatever the teacher's thinking about. Anyway, okay, next.
Just before you go ahead, Steve has a question.
Okay.
Yeah, it's not really a question. It's more an addition. If you've ever watched Tech for Senior with Ron Brown and Huey Poplock, Ron uses that video overview all the time. A lot of the videos that he presents, he just takes them from the video overview and puts their little logo in the corner for Tech for Senior. Because I tried it and I thought, hey, wait a minute, I've seen this before. And then I actually looked at a lot of the ones Ron did, and that's what he does.
So do you have to put like a photograph of yourself in to start it off, or?
No, you just have to collect the right database for it to use for whatever presentation you're trying to make. And then it does an overview of what information you've given it. And it starts, you'll see it'll start off with one, and then it'll come to point two, and there'll be a big two on the screen with arrows and that sort of stuff. Mm. But yeah, if you see a lot of the ones that Ron did, a lot of the ones he's done recently are using the video overview from Notebook LM. Mm-hmm.
Okay, and before we move off this slide, your output you can save to notes as you go along. So at the bottom of this particular slide, that first Bill 60 licensing and accountability, that's that initial paragraph that came back after I first launched the request. And then Bill 60 below regulation of physician titles and so on, that was the question that I asked Notebook LM. Okay, next. This is the report page, all kinds of different report styles. I didn't check them all out, but I had a good look at the briefing doc, and it was excellent. It was a little too long for me, but the good part is that if you had to produce a briefing document, you could take this and just chop out what you don't need. So, yeah, so I found that very interesting. Certainly study guides for students will be invaluable. And the comparison report I looked at as well, it gives you a lot of text, but it also presented me with a chart with Bill 60 and then the nurses and the Ontario Health Coalition in the other column. So two columns, one with points from Bill 60 and then the input from the Ontario Health Coalition and nurses addressing that particular point. So that was good too. Okay, next. This is just my remarks. I thought that I didn't know where the notebook would be stored. I thought it would be in my Google account, but it's not. So it's on notebooklm.google.com. And yeah, finally, it's a very impressive tool. It would save a lot of time, especially going through these big budget bills and so on, if you have any interest in that, or taxation files and so on. So yeah, but it comes across so professional. I think Chris has said this before. It can kind of convince you that it's right, although it may not be right. It's also professional.
Always verify.
Yes. Okay, that's it.
Yeah, one other thing that I think is worth noting about Notebook LM is this is very much a work in progress. They are adding capabilities just ongoing to Notebook LM. So you may come back, you may use it one time and think, oh, no big deal. You come back a week later and all of a sudden there's extra capabilities there. It's pretty amazing.
Okay, thank you very much, Elizabeth. Moving on, we're going to have Tom talk about auto hotkey. Tom, are you sharing your screen? Unmuting and sharing your screen?
Yes, I will be sharing my screen.
Yeah, you've got share capability.
Okay, by the way, I've updated my presentation. I'll be sending a revised copy to you.
Okay, thank you.
Okay, so... Get the PowerPoint. There. I presume everybody can see that.
Yep.
And this is about auto hotkey. So, what is auto hotkey? It's free, it's open source, and it the main purpose is to automate repetitive tasks. You can create, but you can also create custom keyboard shortcuts. It has some access to the Windows API, so you can do a variety of things with it that way. It also is small, simple, fast, and portable, so you can put it on a USB key and carry it with you. And because it uses the Windows API, it's mostly Windows version independent. And let's move the service away. So what are the advantages? Well, you can create custom hotkeys and hot strings. In other words, not just a particular key combination, but a word or whatever you like that will be expanded. You can automate your interactions with any window applications. You can, although I've never looked into this, build fully functional graphical user interfaces using the Windows API. But it's mainly used for processing data from Excel and a variety of sources and moving it around and doing that kind of stuff, as well as expanding text. And you can control external programs through COM objects. You can manage different file operations. You can schedule tasks and do system administration. And there is a large AutoKey community. There are a lot of resources, libraries, and ready-made scripts that may or may not suit you, but because they're all plain text, you can go in and make your own changes to them. And there are thousands of scripts that may suit you the way they are. The first and major, I suppose, most obvious use is to expand text and convert short abbreviations into full phrases automatically. For example, typing BTW could easily expand to by the way, or it could expand to a complete letter if you have an abbreviation that you want to say, answer something or other, and have that expand to a complete letter that you want to reply to. There's also one script that will auto-correct a variety of misspellings on the fly, and it includes 4,700 common English errors. So these are the routine tasks that you can do with an automated copy and paste, often between fields, apps, and modules. And in fact, the main kind of professional use is actually moving things from one document to another document where the documents are structured and it's coming in as it's like an invoice and you want to put it in your accounts payable or something like that. Also, if you're doing something with multiple steps, it makes sense to use auto hotkey if you can automate those steps so that you do it in one key press instead of a dozen or two. You can also initiate and position multiple apps, which is useful. That you can put them on your screen or in your multiple monitors or desktops very easily, and then you know where they are going, and you can set that up for yourself automatically at the start. For example, when you log on or something like that, or when you're addressing some particular thing. You can write routine inquiry replies to inquiries, which is a very common way of sending a whole letter or something where you have text. I mean, you can do this in many of the programs already, but this provides one place to put them all, no matter what program you're using. You can also use them to fill out forms, and you can insert date, time, or even make calculations based on a variety of fields and put that in. So it's good for doing common things that you do all the time. And things that you do all the time, you can automate with AutoHotkey. Application of Windows management. I haven't really gone into this, but you can certainly create custom shortcuts to launch frequently used applications and websites. You can also position windows at specific screen locations and automatically and manage multiple desktops efficiently, or so I've been told. In gaming, it's used a fair bit because it can do multiple steps all at once. It can replicate keyboard actions and mouse actions. And it is fast. It can do things very quickly, more quickly than your fingers can. For system administration, it can automate backups, manage firewalls, manage startup sequences, and it can also monitor connectivity if you want to know if you're online or you can't connect to Google or someplace else. It can actually check for you every so often. There are a lot of available scripts, and here's several of them. One is an always-on top toggle, where you can quickly make any window stay on top of others with a hotkey. You can adjust Windows transparency. You can use your scroll wheel on your mouse as a volume control. And there's more. Lots more. this is the biggest source is probably github.com. AHK script awesome auto hotkey, and it has lots of libraries of things, and clipboard manipulation, console operations, data formatting, blah, 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 blah. And there are a variety of library distributions for various people that are have used particular applications and scripts and tools and tutorials that you don't have to just use things blindly. You can look at the tutorials and check to see what you can do. And there are more and more and more of them. So I would suggest if you're interested in making your life easier by automating common things that you do, especially multiple things you do in a row, that AutoHotkey is a good solution for you. And I'd like to give thanks to SlideSco for giving me the gears. I'm done.
Okay, thank you very much.
Next week, Tom will be back with some sample scripts.
I will show you how to program.
In
AHK, 2 weeks, that's right. I've made two. Well, maybe three minor scripts. One puts the date and the time, and you can, in a format that you can put into a a file name or a folder name or anywhere. And the other is something that makes your Facebook entries look nice, because you can't copy and paste into Facebook, as you probably know. If you want new lines and stuff like that, you need to actually type it in or use AutoHotKey.
Okay, well, yes, we look forward to that. Thank you very much, Tom. Okay, next up, Chris received a question.
Yeah, this came into suggestion box anonymously. So the question was all about subdomains. And so the question was, first question was, can a scammer create a malicious email address by prepending a fake username and a subdomain name to a domain name that is already a trusted domain? So the example that he had for this was receiving an email, an address that ends in rbc.com. So he trusts rbc.com, but it came in as rbcroyalbank@service.rbc.com. And so his question is that email going to be legitimate because it ends in rbc.com and everything that comes before that can be trusted as well? So my answer to that is yes, probably, if you trust rbc.com. The trick to it all is that subdomains of rbc.com are controlled by whoever controls the domain name service for rbc.com. So as a general rule, you would say, well, if it's by the same person, if you can trust RBC, you can trust subdomains as well. But not necessarily, because the subdomain service.rbc.com could be managed separately. So it doesn't have to be managed in one DNS. And it could be poorly managed, or it could be compromised, because it can be a completely separate service. So, but it has to be delegated by whoever owns rbc.com. So trust in the main domain doesn't necessarily guarantee a subdomain is managed properly, is safe, or even whether it's legitimate or not. And while it's no absolute, I would say in the absence of some way of validating that rbc.com is or isn't managing its subdomains in a way that you could say is trustworthy, then overall I would trust the subdomain. So in almost all cases, there's no way for you to validate whether it's actually managed by the same person or group, or whether it's on the same server or anything else like that. So I think that the basic thing to do is just go ahead and trust subdomains. Now, there was a second part that came in on that same email, and that was talking about Unicode characters in domain names. So Unicode characters can be lookalikes to the normal Roman alphabet. So the question is, could a scammer fake a malicious domain containing Unicode characters so that it looks like a legitimate domain? The example given is if you use the Cyrillic A, which is Unicode 0430, and it looks the same in most typefaces as the ASCII A, so apple.com, for example. So if you have the Cyrillic A, it is actually different than the letter A, even though they look alike. So how can we detect if malicious websites are containing Unicode characters? And this is a little bit of a rabbit hole, but most DNS servers don't support Unicode characters directly. Because people can use Unicode characters in domain names, then what they do is they use Punicode, used to encode the Unicode characters to ASCII. And just as an example, in that apple.com, the Cyrillic A, Unicode 0430, followed by pple.com, would actually be converted to xn-pple-43d.com. That is the Punicode for the Cyrillic A, followed by pple.com. If you click such a link, even though it looks like it's Apple because the Cyrillic A looks the same as the ASCII A, if you click the link, modern browsers will actually show you the Punicode. So if you're in the habit of looking at where you're going, then you would actually see that as, rather than apple.com, you'd see that string instead. So the question is, do you actually examine the address bar every time you click a link? I know I don't. And I suspect a lot of people probably don't bother looking at it. They just click a link and they start looking at the page they land on. And another thing is that you may actually be transported to that website, which could be totally different than Apple.com, before you even have the page load. So potentially malicious things could happen as soon as the page loads. So there are some browsers, Chrome being one of them, that could warn deceptive site ahead if they see Unicode characters in domain names. They'll warn you about it, but they will go ahead and send you there anyways. So, you know, if you are not in the habit of examining the address bar every time you click a link and watching for something like that happening, maybe your best approach is to actually manually type in the URL. So you would type in apple.com rather than clicking on a link. And the first thing is like, really? And I'd say if you're way more paranoid than I am, yeah, that's really all you can do. There are some extensions that you can load into browsers that purport to be able to expose Unicode characters and things like that. I haven't looked at any of them. Overall, I would say that this is something that goes way beyond my paranoia level. So I'm not going to bother with it. If anybody else wants to experiment with these and see if they can see if this actually is a good thing or a bad thing or indifferent, I would encourage anybody to do a Q&A on that particular topic.
Tom has put a note in the chat here, click or hover. So I guess he's suggesting if you hover, would that show you the puny code?
Yeah, I don't know myself. Tom, do you know if you hover over a link that is using Unicode characters, will it show the puny code?
I don't know, I'm afraid.
Okay. Okay, anyhow, I think that this is probably an obscure enough thing that most people probably don't really have to worry about it. I certainly don't, and I'm paranoid enough.
Don't click on links.
Don't click on links. But it's a little bit hard to browse the web and not click on links, I must admit.
Well, at least links in email. I agree that...
links in email, for sure. Yeah.
Also, I've noticed that, I mean, I have a couple of Bitly extensions that go to things associated with my Bridge directory. I've noticed lately that the Bitly link actually shows you where it's going to go to before it actually goes there.
That's
a nice interaction. But the same thing with all of the other sort of URL shorteners that give you an indirect link. If they're nice, they'll show you where they're going to go before they actually go there.
One thing I guess you could do, it'll slow you down an awful lot, but before you click on a link, if you install the extension that is available at virustotal.com, when you see a link, you can right-click on it and you can send it to virustotal.com, which will tell you whether that is a suspicious site or not. Now, the trouble with it is that if it's just Unicode, it's not necessarily malicious if it's got Unicode characters. And so it will just go through its standard thing of checking out the site, whether it's a malicious site or not, which can take up to about 30 seconds or a minute before it comes back and says that all our 83 antivirus engines or whatever think that the site is safe. But you could do that if you're really paranoid about clicking on links. So just go to virustotal.com and install their extension into the browser.
Also, if you use a DNS that actually checks for bad sites, then that's a lot safer. Something like Quad9 has an option for that. So does the Canadian site have an option for that.
Yeah.
So that will give you another layer of protection.
Yeah, security on computers is all about layers, so that if one lets you down, hopefully something else will pick it up. So that's a good idea to use a replacement DNS. I use Sierra's, Sierra.ca's Canadian Shield, which is a DNS that can protect you from known malicious sites. And so presumably if somebody is trying to do Apple.com and they're replacing it with the Unicode character 0430 and 30 instead of the A, then presumably they're trying to send you to a malicious site, and hopefully that would be detected by your replacement DNS service.
Okay, thank you very much, Chris. Next up, I have a share on comparing various kinds of what I would consider to be text files, documents at least. Anyway, now I started off using Notepad++ because it does have the facility to compare to ASCII text files. And it has a plugin called Compare, and I've talked about it before. I'll go through it briefly here. But it's really neat if you you want to see the difference between two text files. But then I recently found out that the word processing packages have essentially the same capability. And Writer in the LibreOffice suite will compare ODT files. And so under the Edit menu and Track Changes, there's a Compare Document option. And it turns out that Word will do the same thing for .docx files, and this time it's under Review, and then Compare, and then another submenu where you have a Compare option. And then finally for PDF files, quite a few of the PDF editing type programs will do comparison. Now, however, it's usually a premium feature, so there are not, I don't think there are that many free PDF readers, editors, that will do PDF comparison. But there is a public domain program called PDF Diff, and that does the same thing. So if we look at Notepad++, basically you can see here, this is the index file that I use to create the agenda for Q&A sessions. And I have kind of a running total, so you can see the previous weeks are down here. And then this week is at the top with the various topics. And so what I'm looking at here is I've got two different versions of this file open. On the left here is the version that's on my laptop, the current file I'm working on. And on the right-hand side, on the second tab here, is the version that's on my backup USB flash drive. So that will be the old version because I haven't copied over the new yet. So once I've opened these two files, I can go to plugins. I've already installed the plugin, so I go to compare. It drops down this menu here, and I just say, okay, compare the two files that are already open, and it basically just does a quick and dirty compare. And of course, I have the files the wrong way around, and this is the one on the flash drive, and this is the one that is on my computer. And you can see that all the plus signs here in the green is the new information that I've added for the week of November the 5th. So it's a very quick and easy way to see the differences between the two files. So here I'm looking at basically the same thing, where again I've got the old version in a text in an ODT file in LibreOffice Writer up to October. Or is that the old version or the new version? That must be the old version because this is the new version. It's got October the 29th. So this is the old version and this is the new version with some additional information here has been added to the document. So in this case, I think what I do is I have to open the new file. So I've got that open in my word processor here. And then I think I need to go to the Edit menu, Track Changes, and do Compare Document. And what that does is it pops up this window and says, well, which document do you want to compare it to? So now I have to pull up from my flash drive the same file. And I tell it, yes, I want to use that one. And instantly, it shows me the difference between the two files. So that's, again, a very useful way to find the differences between two document files, which is pretty difficult otherwise. You have to open the two files and go through it manually almost. And so that's a really, really neat way to do it. Now, I mentioned Word does more or less the same thing. So here's a Word document where I think on this one, I've added this text box here, and I've highlighted the thing in yellow so we can see what the difference is. So in Word, I think you do pretty much the same thing. You go to the compare review, the review tab over here, and then you've got the compare option, and you can say compare two versions of a document. So I click on that. I want that. And again, it says, well, what's the original document and what's the new version of the document? So you enter those two things or browse for them. And once you have those two things established, then, so here I'm pulling up my documents here, just browsing for the documents I want to compare. So, okay, so I've got my, I've got one document here, second document here. I just say okay, and the display is kind of messy, but I think you can see that over here on the right hand side, it's showing me the original document with just straight text, and the revised document down here has got the text box with the yellow highlighting. So again, if you've got two Word documents where you've made changes and you want to find out what the differences are between the two documents, then that compare utility is built into Microsoft Word. It can be very handy. Okay, we mentioned PDF files. So here's a PDF file. This is the APCUG, which is the Association of Personal Computer Users Group, of which we are a member. This is a PDF file that tells you all of the presentations and all of the speakers who are offering to give presentations to other groups. So, for example, here's Ray Baxter. He's actually the president of APCUG. But he's offering this package called Technology Changes the Way We Listen to Music. And this is kind of a heads up for our, I think it's our December meeting, is going to be Ray talking about how we listen to music. But what I'm interested in is further down, this guy called Chris Taylor, who seems to be the president of the OPCUG, and he has presentations on things like fun with fonts and how to buy a digital camera and so on. But you notice that this is the June version of the PDF file. In the November version, so now I've opened up the June in, this is PDF Exchange Viewer. I've opened up the June in one tab. Now I've opened up the November version of the same file, or the November version of that Speakers Bureau file. You can see that in addition to Fun with Fonts, there's now a new entry for Chris's artificial intelligence presentation. So if we wanted to compare again these two files, what we could do is use this diff PDF program. Now you'll notice here that this has been developed by somebody, but he's no longer developing it. Presumably at one time he was actually selling this as a commercial product, and now he's no longer offering it for sale. But it turns out that if you look on the web, versions of this thing are all on things like Softronic, FileHippo, forums where you can download various free software, and especially older versions of things. So if you load up diff PDF and you tell it file one is the June version and file two is the November version, it gives you an instant comparison, and it highlights the changes in blue. And you can see that this is the original one where he had fun with fonts and how to buy a digital camera. And now the first listing is now artificial intelligence. So there you go. You can look at text files, ODT files, DocX files, PDF files, and various ways of comparing different kinds of text document files. Okay, that's everything that we have prepared. So we're at that
nothing
point.
Nothing in the chat.
10, and any other questions?
Nothing in the chat.
Any other questions?
Um,
I have a quick question. Did anybody have a trouble with Gmail today? At one point, the Gmail just refused to come up on my Apple phone, on my iPhone. And I thought, oh, my God, I was out and I didn't remember my password. So I just didn't do anything. And then an hour later, I checked again and it came up fine.
This might have been the leftover from the Cloudflare problem that occurred yesterday. Cloudflare was out for about 6 hours, and there's a lot of services that use Cloudflare for global distribution and phishing attempts and things like that, or different attacks that can happen on websites. So it's used as a defense on that, and so maybe lingering effects from that.
Great. I also had a problem the day before that, which is very scary. All of a sudden, my Wi-Fi was fine, but my computer wouldn't acknowledge it. So I did an Ethernet connection, and that didn't work. So I rebooted, and the Ethernet connection worked. I did not a shutdown, the other one. And I had to do that operation twice, and then eventually it came up, and I was able to disconnect the Ethernet cable, and touch wood, it's working now. I have no idea whether it's hardware in my computer or whether there are gremlins out there.
Anytime things like that can happen as a periodic problem for sure. And anytime that occurs, I will shut down everything, and then I will start with the thing that is farthest away from me, which is usually a router, power it up, wait for it to settle down, because most routers can take up to a couple of minutes for it to establish a connection with the internet service provider and so forth. Once it's settled down, then I'll power up the computer. And or if you have a switch in between, you then power up that switch, then you power up your computer, leaving time for each of them to come up and settle down and figure out where they sit, and that often will clear up intermittent problems like that.
Okay, I forgot to reboot my Wi-Fi because I thought it looked fine both on my phone and on the settings on my computer. The Wi-Fi looked like it was full force.
Yeah, every time anything looks like, I mean, taking shortcuts for sure, it's worth it. But if the shortcuts of just, oh, that looks fine, so forth, if that doesn't resolve the problem, then I would do that, power down everything.
Reboot everything.
And then start again from the thing that is closest to the internet service provider, and then working through all of the devices closest to you, which would be your computer, and just one by one bringing them up, allowing them time to settle down, make sure that they've got their connection correctly, and then that's the best route I've found.
So it's probably not hardware on my computer.
I wouldn't think so. Not if it's working.
Awesome.
Now.
Yeah, it's working fine. Now, touch wood.
Yeah.
I didn't want to say that. You didn't hear me say that.
Yeah, most electronic devices have a sanity check when they start. And they go back to a known good thing. So that's why a lot of the solutions proposed by people to problems is this, have you rebooted? Yeah. In other words, have you started it over again? Because they go back to a known situation, and then they do a sanity check, and then they go on.
Okay, I won't panic.
No, I don't.
A bit more time with my precious Windows 10 Acer.
And I've heard it said, too, that when you do reboot stuff, don't just flick it off and on. Like, turn it off and let it sit off and let the capacitors drain for 5 minutes and just...
Right. Go get a cup of tea.
Yeah, go get a cup of tea, use a toilet, just, walk around, pet the cat, whatever. Kick the modem.
Thanks, guys.
Didn't know petting the cat was a recommended practice. That's interesting. Okay, on to the wrap-up section. All you people out there who are using word processors, you must be writing stories or articles about computer hardware or computer software or failure of Wi-Fi systems. Our hardworking editor of the monthly newsletter is looking for new articles. Anything which is computer related, it will be welcome. And Bridget's inbox is always open to receive your contributions. Okay, coming up at the library, we have another one of these Battles of the Titans. On Saturday, November 22nd, Chris is going to be talking about AI at Nepean Centrepoint. But Linda is going to be talking about travel through Iceland at North Gloucester. And they're within half an hour of each other, so you ain't going to be able to see both. And then on Monday the 24th, Chris has got a session on protecting your PC at the Emerald Plaza. That's in the evening at 6 p.m. As usual, lots of other presentations, as Chris pointed out in the pre-meeting deck, lots of other presentations at the library. If you go to the URL there, that will take you to a list of all of the OPCUG presentations. And if you want to attend any of them, then you have to register with the library. Okay, we are at November the 19th. Next week is the 26th. And Chris and I are taking the night off Zoom. We will not have an electronic Q&A on the 26th, next Wednesday, because we're all going to be at the Big Rig in Gloucester Center. So as I said earlier, if you have questions, we'll be more than happy to sip our ale and try to give you some answers at the same time. However, what that means is that the next Q&A on Zoom will be in 2 weeks' time on December the 3rd. So if you have questions or if you have follow-ups on things we've talked about tonight, if you have topics like the one that Elizabeth and the one that Tom gave tonight, thank you very much, guys. If you have topics that you'd like to share with the group, just send us a few details to suggestion box at opcug.ca, and as usual, we'll be happy to add you to the agenda. I think that's it for me. I'm looking forward to meeting everybody who's going to be at the Big Rig, and we'll see you there.
See you there, folks.